The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Hello, and welcome to the American College of Osteopathic Internists Annual Convention and Scientific Sessions. This year's meeting was held in conjunction with the Annual Clinical Assembly of the American College of Osteopathic Surgeons. The meeting was held October 11th through 15th, 2017, and featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of interest to the practicing physician. The meeting was held at the Gaylord National Resort and Convention Center in National Harbor, Maryland. The program chair is Dr. Annette Karen, and the theme for this year's presentations is Goldilocks Medicine, Not Too Little, Not Too Much. Urticaria is presented by Dr. Julie Sturbank.
Okay, and as I mentioned before, I don't have any financial disclosures or conflicts of interest to share. And I'm not going to read slides to you. I selectively read slides, but I don't believe in reading slides. So you can certainly read this slide and be familiar, and I'm happy to answer questions. Okay, myth number one. Food allergy is extremely common and symptoms last days at a time. Does anybody think that that's true? Is that anybody? I know I'm going to put you on the spot. You guys are going to have to, we're going to have to do some participation here. But does anybody think that that's true? Does anybody know what's wrong with that statement? So I'll tell you it's not true, but does anybody know what's wrong with that statement? True. You know, I should update my presentation to include that it's fake news. That's right. Absolutely. Good idea. So what's wrong with this statement is actually that symptoms don't last for days at a time. Okay? So I always tell the people in my clinic, and my nurses have heard me say this before, like, we try to have fun in clinic. So I always remind them that if Dr. Sturbank found that she was allergic to some food, especially things like tree nuts or fish or shellfish, it would not be a happy day in the office. And they laugh at me when I say it, but I hate food allergy. And the reason why I hate food allergy is I don't have a treatment right now for food allergy. So just coming on the cusps of all of this, I mean, there's some discussion about whether or not we should be desensitizing high-risk patients to peanuts. And you probably have seen that because it's been on the national news. And I'll be honest with you, I do think that's where we're moving, but it's not really prime time, at least not yet. So we're working on that. So right now, when I identify a food allergy, unfortunately, my treatment is you have to avoid it and you have to have an epinephrine auto-injector, right? So that's not so fun. Because, right, we like to be able to solve problems, or at least that's what I like. Okay, so while it's not what I would call uncommon, I wouldn't say that it's incredibly common. But the things that I do want you to take away from this is the most common foods that are involved in food allergy, and this is going to be over 90% of food allergy are going to be milk, eggs, peanut, tree nut, wheat, soy, fish, and shellfish. Okay? So when you have somebody who comes to your clinic and says, I think I'm allergic to pineapple, watermelon, trying to think of some of the cantaloupe, some of the other melons, chances are that's not true food allergy. And actually, in that case, what I would go so far as to say that may be something called oral allergy syndrome. But also, for you in taking care of adults, what I would say is, it is very uncommon to have a milk or an egg allergy that persists into adulthood. So where we see milk and egg allergy is in young children where their immune system has not matured. So if you have an adult that's coming in and saying, I think I'm allergic to milk or I think I'm allergic to egg, most likely they may very well be having symptoms, but it's going to be more likely to be food intolerance. So for example, lactose intolerance and not a true food allergy. So I do spend a lot of time talking to people about that. The same thing with egg. So for example, I see the employees through employee health who are refusing to get a flu vaccine because they have an egg allergy. And my most recent one, the woman came in and said, I have an egg allergy. So of course, as part of the history, the first thing I said was, well, what happens when you eat egg? And she said, nothing, actually, I eat them every day. And I said, okay, did you tell your provider down in the employee health center that that's what you do? Because let me assure you that that's not going to be an egg allergy. And she proceeded to tell me, and this is not that uncommon. I mean, we laugh about it, but it's not that uncommon. She proceeded to tell me when she was 14, now mind you, she's in her 40s now, but when she was 14, she actually had an egg dish as part of a brunch, and she became ill after that. So she just assumed that it was egg allergy. So again, if somebody is going to be egg allergic, and I sort of understand why she made that correlation, but the thing to keep in mind is if they're truly going to be allergic, they're going to have symptoms, not necessarily always the exact same symptoms, but symptoms every time they have an exposure, okay? So just keep that in mind. So when you get somebody who comes in and says, it happens sometimes, that's most likely not going to be a food allergy. And then, like I said, the takeaway for this is, for you guys, is very unusual to see a milk or an egg allergy that persists into adulthood. I think I've only seen one. So just keep that in mind. So anyway. And then most common allergens in children are going to be peanut, milk, and shellfish, believe it or not. And then I included some of the prevalences of food allergy, just so you have that in case you're interested. And then this is, again, what was wrong with that statement there was that these typically occur with, the symptoms will occur within minutes of the exposure. So the outer limit of food allergy is usually about 2 hours. So if somebody starts having, you know, oftentimes we'll see it within minutes or with when something touches their mouth, right? But you can have it where they'll say, well, 30 minutes afterwards, all of a sudden I started vomiting and I felt weak and then I fainted. You can have that, okay? So some people won't respond immediately, but it's usually within a 2-hour time window. Now, there are occasionally things that go beyond that, but you're going to be referring anyway, but these are just helpful clues to keep in mind when you're trying to figure out what might be going on with a patient. And I don't know if any of you are familiar with this, but does anybody know about the Teal Pumpkin Project? So this is important because I oftentimes talk in the fall, but the Teal Pumpkin Project is part of the Food Allergy and Research and Education Organization. They used to be I always forget what their name was before. I guess that's good, so I won't tell you what their name was before. But Teal Pumpkins, so if you are handing out Halloween candy, because this is where kids oftentimes get in trouble or people get in trouble. And you want to hand out what we call allergy-safe treats for trick-or-treating, then you're supposed to display a teal pumpkin so that our food allergy kids know that you have something that you can give them that's not going to have things like tree nuts in them. That's probably tree nuts or peanut, because that's going to be the biggest thing that they usually run into problems with. So if you're ever looking for ideas for that, I mean, there are lots of things you can do. You can do stickers, you can do markers, you can do pens, you can do, I've seen people do crayons. You can actually buy small packages of crayons that are actually very reasonable, and I think that's actually what I'm going to do this year is probably do small packages of crayons, because then they can get donated if we don't use them all during the trick-or-treat. So just keep in mind teal pumpkin for my kids who have food allergies. Okay, and so that's some information about the Teal Pumpkin Project. And a slide about intolerance versus allergy. And just to keep in mind the difference, the biggest way to tell the difference is that food allergy really incites the immune system. So there's cross-linking of those antibodies that we talked about in the first talk. There's degranulation of the mast cell. There are all these symptomatic kinds of things that happen due to the histamines and all the different mediators. And we usually just focus on histamine, but there are a lot of different mediators. And then to remember that intolerance is more where people will have symptoms, but it generally does not incite the actual immune system for a response. So that's the kind of the technical difference. Okay. And I just list some common intolerances here that you probably hear about all the time, including migraine triggers. So I'll get people who will come in and want to be tested because they think the food allergy is causing their migraines. And most often, I mean, it can be a food trigger, but most often is not, unfortunately, going to be a food allergy. So unfortunately, my testing, which is for IgE-mediated responses, generally doesn't help your migraineur, unfortunately. Okay, and we'll keep going. Okay, so dogs can be hypoallergenic. Has anybody ever heard that one before? True or false? Probably you know because it's in my talk, right, that it's false. I always kind of jokingly say, too, I think, is this, it's in the dander. And I always say that if Dr. Sturbank could have a hypoallergenic dog, she would have one, and she doesn't. So trust me, they're not hypoallergenic. So you will get people who sometimes experience urticaria in contact due to their saliva. So you'll have people that'll get licked by a cat or dog. And we see it a lot in kids, but it can happen in adults as well. And some proteins in the dog or cat, unfortunately, we can't test for all of the proteins that are in all of the species for dogs and cats. Those are the ones that probably are the biggest implicators that people come in to see me for. But we try to at least test for major allergens. And I always say, or as Dr. Ted Scherer, who taught me, would say, unless you have a skinless pet, there is no hyperallergenic cat or dog. So, and those are my babies. So I say right there, you can tell I don't have a hypoallergenic dog. So those are my babes. Okay, myth number three. Chronic rhinitis symptoms are almost always related to allergies, especially in young children. True or false? So you probably already know, like I said, it's in my presentation, it's going to be false, right? And the reason why I'm pointing this one out is because we get people referred to us all the time that have been diagnosed as having allergies by their primary care physician or their urgent care physician or the emergency room physician, and then they come in and they get testing and they're frustrated because they find out that they don't have that. So I just want to mention that if we had three people standing up here, and I was one of the three, I would be one of the allergic three, but there would be at least one of us that would have chronic rhinitis symptoms that are not allergic. And so if they're not allergic, what does that mean? That usually means that they suffer from vasomotor rhinitis. It can be other things. You can have problems with drainage associated with anatomical defects, so your deviated septum and those kinds of things. But you have to keep in mind that really the only way that you're going to know whether or not this is truly allergy or not is going to be to test it. So I just always say, be careful what you tell your patients, because I will get people to say, well, but my doctor said, and, you know, what can I say other than their testing doesn't support that? And I understand why they got labeled with that diagnosis, but in general, just be aware, the only way you're going to know for sure is if you test it. And then my last point on this slide is important as well. People who have chronic headaches, and they'll say that they have chronic sinus headaches, and I'll admit, I was one of them too until I got my allergies treated. I always thought they were sinus headaches. Well, in general, sinuses do not cause headaches. So the things you have to keep in mind are, and I always explain to patients that you can have trigeminal involvement for migraines, and yes, it seems like it's right here, and people will say, but it's right here, Dr. Sturbank. And I tell them that I do understand that because that's actually how my migraines present, but I got my allergies treated, and I did really well with allergy immunotherapy, and unfortunately, the headaches didn't go away. So that's when I finally realized that I was suffering from migraines. Okay, this is another one because you guys probably have a lot of people on ACEs. So ACE inhibitors are a common cause of angioedema. Anybody? You agree? Got a few. Just a few. Okay, got a handful. So I'm going to tell you that, yes, it does happen. It's not that common. So when I threw these numbers up on the slides for my ER physicians, they were, like, blown away that it wasn't higher. Because they see a lot of angioedema, and they see a lot of people on ACE inhibitors, right? Because we have a lot of diabetics that are through our system. And so I just mentioned to you that when you see somebody who has angioedema and they're on an ACE inhibitor, it may or may not be related. Unfortunately, we do not have testing available for that. So what happens is I tell all of our patients that suffer from angioedema and chronic angioedema, it is appropriate to stop the ACE inhibitor. You can use an ARB as a substitute. But the thing that will help us figure out if it really was related to the ACE inhibitor or not is time. And as time goes on, if we've stopped the ACE inhibitor and they continue to have episodes, then we know it wasn't the ACE inhibitor, right? So unfortunately, we don't have testing that we can confirm this. But usually what I say to people is, again, okay to stop it. Actually, that's what I would recommend. If you have somebody who's having angioedema, you should not use ACE inhibitors on them anyway. Put them on an ARB if you want the renal protective effects, or choose another agent if the renal protective effects aren't as important. And then just be aware if your patient is African American, there appears to be increased risk with this. And very rarely these people will progress to obstruction, but it's unusual. I have seen it. It is very scary. So obviously I tell all my patients that if they start feeling this reaction or whatever episode that they're feeling, if they start feeling like it's going like the freight train that you can't stop, I'm like, call 911. Do not drive yourself to the ED. Do not ask somebody else to drive you to the ED, call 911, and don't play around with it. No one will ever second guess you for that. So I know they're always, I get, especially the men in my clinic are like, really, do I really have to do this? Yes, you do, because the end result is you want that person to be safe, and that's all that really matters. So this is, as I was talking before, you'll see it more in lips and eyes, just because there's less connective tissue there. Okay. Allergic reactions, whether caused by inhalant allergens such as pollen, food, or drugs, are worse with subsequent exposure. So if you were listening to my talk, I already talked about this the previous talk. So we don't have studies that support that, right? Because once we know somebody has a severe allergic reaction, we don't just keep giving them the medication or the food again to see what happens, right? So from that standpoint, we don't know. We think that there's a theoretical risk of that, but we don't know. But I do point out that in inhalant allergens, we do not prescribe EpiPens or EpiAuto injectors for those. Those can look very impressive if you have young children. Especially in the spring with tree pollen, we get a lot of eye symptoms with that. But again, these are not folks that are generally at risk for anaphylaxis. And then on the bottom there, I just have a caveat about venom stings. So large local reactions to venom stings or even mosquito bites do not indicate an increased risk of systemic reactions to stings. And aren't considered an allergic phenomenon. They are an immune phenomenon, and they can get very large and even sometimes painful, but they generally are not going to cause people, and they don't put people at increased risk for systemic reactions. So if you're able to say that to your patients and they still want a referral, hey, I'm great with that, but it's often helpful to at least start planting that seed, because I'll still get people who, even when I explain this to them and tell them this, they don't really want to hear that. Okay. Dust mites, like bed bugs, bite and cause generalized itching and rashes. Does anybody think that's true? True? False? Anybody? No? So this one kind of creeped me out of a little bit at first. I'm like, first of all, I'm dust mite allergic, and I'm thankful that they are microscopic, because I would not want to see these things, okay? But never mind that. But anyway, this one is, I always say, be careful of what you read on the internet. So I wasn't able to link this, but what I would tell you is, so I'm putting together this talk, and one of the things that I'll routinely do is I'll search on the internet just because I want to see what's out there and see what people are reading. And there's this website that actually shows alleged pictures of rashes from dust mites, and they don't bite, okay? They actually live on dead skin cells, okay? And not to be graphic, but it's actually their feces that we're allergic to, that humans are allergic to. It's a very common allergen. So just be aware that some of the stuff out there, you never know what people read. But I just think it's fun every once in a while to kind of like look out there when I'm researching and going to do a talk about what's out there currently, because that's what people are reading. And they don't really know any better, right, to look for reasonable or recognized resources. Okay, so myth number 7. Inhaled allergens, pollen, pet dander, dust, and dust mites are a common cause of acute urticaria. Any takers for true? I do think I have some that are in here that are true. So this one could be true. Anybody voting for true? Got a few, okay. Who's voting for false? Who's not voting at all? Okay. All right, just checking. All right, so the reason why I put this one in is because actually acute urticaria, so as we were talking about in the last talk, they're episodes that occur of less than 6 weeks of duration. So why is that? It's because the studies that they've done, typically when people go over 6 weeks, tends to be more of a chronic nature, tend not to be allergic. Acute urticaria can be allergic, but the most common things that it's going to be from are not going to be inhalant allergens, okay? It's going to be a new food, a new drug, or a venom sting, okay? So the most common causes outside of allergy are going to be infection and susceptible individuals who have issues with pressure, heat, or cold-induced urticaria. So when you see somebody who has acute urticaria, child or adult, what you're going to try to look for, if you think it's allergic, is going to be a new food, a new drug, or a venom sting, okay? Outside of that, believe it or not, it's most likely non-allergic. So what I always say to people is at least treat the symptoms, and then unless there's an obvious trigger, I mean, yes, you can have them follow up with an allergist immunologist, but the guidelines don't even suggest that we test in those individuals that have acute urticaria unless there is an obvious implicated trigger, okay? So most of the times we don't test in those situations. And most of the times we hope that it's one and done, that they've had this episode, it was some weird viral trigger that's in the community and it moves on and they don't have that again, but it does happen. So these are just some other facts about acute urticaria, and they estimate that 20% of us in our lifetime are going to experience it at least once. Personally, I hope not, because when I've seen people who have it, they're miserable, but I haven't yet, so maybe eventually. And then to just keep in mind that there are things that we use all the time that are actually, by their own method of action, mast cell degranulators. So those things are things like the narcotics, aspirin, radiocontrast media, NSAIDs, and muscle relaxers. So the best way I can describe it to patients is everyone has a little bit of a different set point. And for certain people, certain things are just enough to kind of nudge them over the edge for them to have urticaria. So I do see people who respond to NSAIDs and aspirins that do develop hives. I do sometimes also see it in some of the opioids. Most commonly, I'll get referrals from, say, the orthopedic surgeons because they want to do a joint replacement and they want to know what are their options for pain control. But just keep those things in mind. So good news, bad news is good news. Some of these patients will tolerate certain NSAIDs within the group. Many of these patients will not have breathing symptoms in addition to the skin symptoms, but it is helpful to know what your options are if you know you're going to be doing something painful to a patient and we need to be able to control their pain. Okay, chronic urticaria, so just a little bit of additional information so you have this, is these episodes occur in greater than 6 weeks in duration. Again, most days of the week, so what your depends a little bit on what your most definition is. 3 is kind of right on the borderline. 4 probably qualifies. They're rarely allergic in nature. And I was mentioning I typically treat them with high-dose H1, H2 blockade, and sometimes I do have to use very high dosages. And for patients, it's scary, but I do try to explain to them that the good news with oral antihistamines is they're very well-tolerated, they're generally very safe medications, and they don't interact with a lot of other medications. A side note is they're relatively inexpensive, so as long as you're dealing with generics, Most people can afford them, so even if they have to use the high dosages. But I'll be honest with you, most patients get pretty upset with me when I explain to them that they need to be taking two of their cetirizine in the morning and two of the cetirizine in the evening. To them, that seems like a lot of medicine because it's multiple pills, right? So they don't really like that, but I always say it's much better to use that than have to go to some of these systemic treatments. Okay, we'll keep going here. These are just other things that are implicated in chronic urticaria to keep in mind. This is what they look like. I'm always forever preaching that you have to make sure that you are dealing with hives when people use the term hives, because I have people who come to me all the time that say they have hives, and if you ask them to show you pictures, they are not hives. So you want to remember that they're typically erythematous plaques that have a central pallor to them. They typically are blanching. They are intensely itchy. And I always suggest to patients, if you ever have any questions about rashes, tell them, take a picture. Because invariably, especially with the moms, they'll always say, see, I brought them to the doctor and the rash is gone. So the cell phone pictures aren't always helpful, but you have nothing to lose. So have them snap a picture, and then, you know, yeah, then they can take their antihistamine or whatever they want to try for the rash. So at least you have something to go back to. But again, you want to make sure that you're dealing actually with a true hive, because some things that people have that they come in with are not hives. And I actually have had referrals for people who have issues with, this is dermatographism, for those of you who kind of, these are kind of pretty dramatic examples, but so people who are hive with any type of scratch or trauma. There we go. Okay, myth number eight, and I promise we're almost done and then you guys get a break, okay? So patients with urticaria and angioedema are most likely having allergic reactions and are at risk for anaphylaxis. True or false? Okay, I hope you would say false, but not everybody would. But the reason why I say that is it's possibly true, right? So that's where you need to use your clinical judgment. And like I said, if it appears like the freight train is going and it's not stopping, those are the folks that you do have to worry about anaphylaxis in. And you're not wrong to give epinephrine, but just so you know that even if you have somebody in front of you that has acute urticaria and you give epinephrine, they're going to improve anyway. Okay, so that in and of itself, is not diagnostic for an allergic reaction, because what it is it's a vasoconstrictor, right? And so part of the presentation of urticaria is vasodilation. So if you give them a vasoconstrictor, they're gonna look better and they're gonna feel better. But unfortunately, it can be only temporary. Oftentimes, it's only temporary because the epinephrine doesn't stay on board very long. And so just keep in mind that that's not diagnostic of anaphylaxis. But you want to make sure that, again, you go back to that history. If it's something that's going to be allergic, like a new food, a new drug, a sting, then those are absolutely the people that you're going to worry about going into anaphylaxis, and you do want to treat aggressively. So, and when I say aggressively, I mean all hands on deck. It's totally fine to give them epinephrine, antihistamine, steroids if they need O2 as well, and then fluids if they need it as well. Okay. Myth number nine, proven treatments for acute anaphylaxis include antihistamine, steroids, and epinephrine. So this one, oftentimes, we've seen it on the boards a lot. So yes, no, maybe. What do you guys think? Oh, I think I heard it over here. What did you guys say? Just epinephrine, absolutely. So, okay, whoops. So you want to remember that, oops, I think I didn't go forward here. Let me go here. Yeah, there we go. So first and foremost, you want to give epinephrine IM. These other treatments, they are totally acceptable, but they are not going to stop an anaphylactic reaction, okay? So yes, when you give steroids and antihistamines, you're trying to provide comfort and relief for the patient, but those are not going to be the things that are going to stop it. So if you really do have hemodynamic instability, you're trying to stop that from happening, but you're at that point, you just need to get epinephrine on board. And I can tell you, I did see a child in fellowship where we were doing a challenge to tilapia, and we were doing it in office with a very low RAS level, and the child did anaphylaxis. And let me tell you, when it goes bad, it's scary. So she actually ended up getting 6 doses of epinephrine before we got her into the ambulance. And ironically, she actually did quite well. So after the 6th dose, she actually looked good. So when she got to the emergency room, and I was calling the emergency room, letting them know what was going on and that she was coming, she actually looked like a peach, you know, and so the ED attending, I'm sure, thought I was crazy, but that's okay. I mean, you know, that's what you want, right? You want them to recover and look great, and sometimes after multiple doses of epinephrine, they do, but just be aware that if the freight train starts rolling, you want all hands on deck. Okay. Eczema or atopic dermatitis is caused by allergy. That one you should probably all remember from my last talk, right? So that's going to be not true. Mainly, it's going to be caused by a faulty skin barrier and the protein structure of the skin. Typically, it is inherited, just so you know. So you may get people who where you say, so is there a family history of bad atopic dermatitis? And a lot of times with the kids, we will have parents, when they have this really severe disease, they will have parents who will say, yes, I still have it, or yes, mine was bad like this when I was a child. So just keep that in mind. Can be associated with allergy, but oftentimes it's not. Typically, it improves from childhood to adulthood and sometimes resolves completely, but there are also adult onset forms as well. And so these are some of these that, oops, look kind of bad. Okay, and then I just do some tips for allergy referral. So again, when you talk to an allergist, they're mainly focused on, my specialty is related to immediate hypersensitivity. There are other reactions that involve other types of parts of the immune system. So for example, contact dermatitis. But that's going to be more of a delayed hypersensitivity. So the reason why I say it's good for you to know the specialist in your area that you refer to is because we don't make it easy for people, right? Because some of us allergists, we do patch testing for delayed hypersensitivity, and some of us don't. And some of the dermatologists do, and some of them don't. So the hard part is, unless you really know what your specialist offers, you can kind of get led astray, and you can send somebody to allergy who in turn would have been probably a little bit better helped by dermatology outright. Now, most of us, there's enough overlap that we can at least do some things for the patient in the interim until you can get to the right specialist, but it's often nice to know your specialists and know who offers what service to try to help get people to the right place the first time, right? So I do skin prick testing, and I think I have pictures of that in here. Yeah, so this is skin prick testing. So you can see the little dots there where they're numbering where the scratches are. You can see that they're reactive where they're red and inflamed. The trick is, this is again what I said was immediate hypersensitivity, so it's associated with IgE-mediated disease. It does not find delayed hypersensitivity reactions, so that's why I was saying immediate hypersensitivity, know kind of what your provider offers. Other tips to include, we can't do testing usually during acute rashes. The other thing is, if you anticipate that your patient is going to need skin testing, you can suggest that they try to stop oral antihistamines ahead of time. My experience with that is that people get confused a lot about this, and I would say what I tell patients and what we tell them in our clinic is, if you anticipate you think you're going to need testing and you can comfortably stop your oral antihistamines ahead of time, you may. But even if you have to take oral antihistamines, say if it's a chronic urticaria patient and they break out with hives again and they're miserable, we always say take your antihistamines and come to the appointment anyway. We will figure it out. So we can always make a plan to do testing in the future if we need to. The other thing to keep in mind is if you think your patient had anaphylaxis, unfortunately, there's a refractory period, or fortunately, as the case may be. So if you think about that, the mediators have all been chewed up in this reaction, and we don't want to test during that refractory period because they're not going to respond to my testing. So we usually wait 2 to 3 weeks if we think that somebody has had anaphylaxis before we consider doing testing. But if you have patients that have nasal disease and asthma, you want to continue the inhalers. It's really the oral medications that can interfere with skin prick testing. And then delayed hypersensitivity, which I started talking about. So these are the people who, when they come in contact with something, they're responding to something that's actually coming in contact. So metals, dyes, emulsifiers, those kinds of things. And I'll be honest with you, they tend to be kind of a pain in the tush to really test. And I do talk to patients about that, even though I'm boarded to do patch testing. I do not do patch testing in my clinic, mainly because my partners are not boarded to do it. And we have the reagents over in dermatology. They are very expensive. But the testing itself is really annoying because you put these tests on. Let's see if I have a picture. Yeah. So this is patch testing. So they're kind of the size of like maybe either a small cell phone, maybe a little bit larger than a credit card. Typically, they have 6 to 8 different reagents on them. And people have to put these things on their backs for, or depending upon how many things you test for actually 48 hours. And you can't get your back wet. So we always warn them that you have to kind of be a little bit creative about what you do in terms of bathing. You may want to sponge bathe. You may not want to. In general, we don't suggest working out because sometimes the patches will just come off from sweating. They're coming up with better adhesives for that, but still, it's a pain. It's uncomfortable to have these things on your back. So you come back in 48 hours, they take off the patches, they do the initial read where they're looking for an irritant reaction. But what you're really looking for is actually, you come back in 2 more days, and what you're looking for is a reaction that shows up then. And that's going to be more of your adaptive immunity, and that's going to be your delayed hypersensitivity. So just keep in mind, a lot of my patients won't even go this far to do the testing just because it's a pain. And if they know that it's something in particular that they used, they'll just stop using it. But the advantage to referring people for this is if they don't know what they used, what they can do is they can do the testing. They actually put the information into, there's some pretty sophisticated computer systems now, and they produce something called a safe list for the patient. And so what it does is it gives them brands of different things within different categories. And it's like everything from makeups to body wash to deodorants, all kinds of different personal care products of things that they should be able to use and not have a reaction to it. So for some patients, it's actually very helpful. But like I said, it kind of depends on the situation and the history. If they know what it is, a lot of times they won't go this far to do the testing. And I think that's reasonable, you know, because it's not a fun process to go through. And that's all I have for you guys today. So we're going to have a little bit of an extended break here. So, but does anybody have any questions that you'd like to ask? Sure, please.
At what point do you throw up your hands and give them the diagnosis of idiopathic urticaria?
I'm sorry, what was the first part of it?
At what point do you give a patient the diagnosis of idiopathic urticaria?
Okay, so usually the question was, at what point do you give the patient the diagnosis of chronic idiopathic urticaria? So depending upon the history, and some of your patients who come in, they're not able to move beyond not getting allergy tested, right? So if I can allergy test them and that's really what they want, I don't want to say that I wouldn't allergy test. But in general, I explain to them what it is and what I think it is based on the history. I usually draw labs, and so I do basic labs like checking, as I was mentioning before, liver and kidney function, so that's relatively easy to do, right, a BMP and LFT. The immunoglobulins oftentimes just to make sure that everything looks okay with that. And then usually try to suppress their hives for about a month and have them come back so that we can go over the lab work together. That's the usual plan because usually we don't find anything in those labs, right? So if I don't find anything in those labs and the allergy testing is negative and they continue to have hives past 6 weeks of duration, then that's pretty much a chronic idiopathic urticaria person. So I hope that answers it, yeah. Do we want to Go ahead.
I have a question.
Sure.
When is RAS testing enough, and when is it not enough? When do we refer?
Okay, so the question was, when is RAS testing enough and when is it not when you're referring? So what I would say is this. In general, I will not repeat skin testing in somebody who has been RAS tested, but that's because in our clinic, and I suspect in other places, they have a RAS panel that I don't have anything additional to test on skin testing. So for seasonal allergies, in general, I won't repeat testing in those situations, but I will work with the patient to try to kind of control their disease. Because I'll tell you honestly, my experiences, my internists, and even the people who train me are not super comfortable with using multiple different kinds of nasal sprays and antihistamines in combination, and sometimes those are the patients that we need to do that with. So from that standpoint, for seasonal allergies, I wouldn't repeat it. For penicillin, we do penicillin testing in a graduated fashion. So I start with RAS testing to the major and minor components of penicillin, and then also to amoxicillin. And as long as that's negative, then I would have them come back in for there is additional skin testing. And it's just because our RAS testing for the major and minor components and amoxicillin, there is a strong positive predictive value, but there's still a significant portion that will test negative and will still have a reaction. So that's why we do it in those situations. And then in general, I would say I don't recommend panel testing people for food allergies with RAS, just because if those are your atopic dermatitis people and those are your atopic people, they have a high risk of getting false positives, and then they think they're allergic to a food that they're not. So I don't know if that helps. Did you want to?
Yeah, if somebody's lab test for the RAS panel at your local LabCorp, let's say, is totally negative and you're still suspicious that they have allergies, is it appropriate to refer to you folks?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's good to. So the question is, if you have RAS testing that is negative and people are still having symptoms, is it appropriate to refer? And I would say absolutely. But keep in mind, that's because the specialist can at least take the history and try to determine better or not if it fits an allergic picture. And again, it may be more of an intolerance picture, but it doesn't hurt to refer. And I'm always, I always say, if you don't know, refer. I mean, that's what I do. I you don't want to dismiss the patient. So,
you have one too? Okay.
Okay. Go ahead.
Very quickly.
Sure.
I have many patients that tell me they have iodine allergies, mm-hmm. and I need a contrast dye study.
Yeah.
I was always taught that there's not that much iodine in the contrast dye. Can you comment on that?
A little bit more about contrast media dye allergies.
Yeah. Do they need prednisone before they get their study?
So, yes. So, actually, at our institution, the question was about iodine in the radio contrast media. So, those tend to be mast cell degranulating type things for patients. So, a couple things. At least in our institution, those patients don't get referred to us anymore, because there's actually a protocol that actually occurs in radiology that the radiologists have put together for antihistamines and steroids that they give ahead of time. So, and when I say ahead of time, there is actually, people will do, it's like 12 hours before, 6 hours before, and 1 hour before. But different people use different protocols for it, where they will give oral steroids or IV steroids and then also give antihistamines for it. And then the other thing that they do is, we know now that those people who have reacted in the past, typically those were with some of the older iodine-based therapies, and we found that if you use a lower molecular weight contrast dye, that they oftentimes won't react. So those two things in combination we usually use in our institution, and like I said, I mean, rarely I'll get somebody who still gets sent to me, but in general, they actually don't get sent because people are aware of that, and so they just do that protocol. I hope that helps. Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
Two quick questions.
Sure.
Is there a significant difference in the pathogenesis of severe eczema and atopic dermatitis? And have you or your colleagues used methotrexate for patients with severe eczema?
So the question was about whether or not that there's a significant difference in the pathophys of atopic dermatitis versus severe eczema. I would say, in general, those terms are kind of used interchangeably. So, and really the path, when you take an actual biopsy, it usually isn't very different. So in general, I would say I don't think that there is, but I'm obviously not a pathologist, but not in terms of what I see. And then the second part of the question is whether or not we've used methotrexate. In my clinic, I don't, just because, as I had mentioned before, I wasn't trained to use methotrexate. I will use a tiny, small dose of cyclosporin. But again, if they're contraindicated for cyclosporin, I typically refer them to a colleague who does use methotrexate. And I'll be honest with you, I think I'm actually pretty aggressive in our clinic. I'm med peds trained, so I'm pretty comfortable with treating the adults with some of these other concurrent types of things. My partners are all pediatric trained, and so I think they tend to be a little bit more conservative than me. So I don't see them using a lot of systemic treatments in atopic derm. So I think those patients get referred quite a lot to me just because I'm at least comfortable with it. Hope that helps. Okay. Anybody else? I also have a handwritten question. Okay, so they wanted to know, can you please explain rhinitis metachymosa and talk about diagnosis or a treatment? Okay, so rhinitis metachymosa typically are people who overuse nasal sprays, but usually what they're overusing is going to be your pseudoephedrins or your Afrin nasal sprays. So my nasal spray, the steroid, is not typically something that's implicated in this problem. And then I also use, the other thing that I use a lot of is a nasal antihistamine. So the problem with the nasal antihistamines is they taste god-awful. And I can honestly say that because I've tasted them, and they're really bad. But at any rate, any of the drugs in that class tend to taste bad. So usually first-line therapy is going to be Flonase, followed by something like, or Flonase or a steroid nasal spray, I should say fluticasone, versus Astilin, which is azelastine, is a add-on therapy for people who are still having symptoms, who are miserable and still having swelling. If you're going to have somebody who's going to use an Afrin-like spray, I usually say the best you probably can do is like 3 days on, 3 days off to try to help with this. And, you know, the bottom line, too, is I don't have a problem referring patients over to ear, nose, and throat to have them take a look if they continue to have symptoms despite aggressive medical management of their nasal issues, because they can offer their turbinate reduction. Now, that sounds horrible, and I try not to put people through that if I don't really think that that's going to help. But in terms of quality of life, I mean, some of these people, when you look at their scans, they have so much tissue there. You know, there's only going to be so much that we can do medically. So those are the people that then I do also send over to have ENT at least take a look and give me an opinion about whether or not they think turbinate reduction will help.